Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Parker Lewis, who is a writer and head of business development at Unchained Capital, a company that provides Bitcoin financial services, including multisig vaults, a trading desk, Bitcoin-backed loans, and Bitcoin IRAs. Parker is perhaps best known for writing a series of blog posts and articles under the title of Gradually, Then Suddenly, which is a really good bunch of pieces of writing. And each one of them is focused specifically on one question around Bitcoin, which acts as a very potent orange pill if you get asked about any of these topics, particularly, you know, if some from people who are skeptical of Bitcoin who have questions about it, you know, well, what if government bans it, or what, you know, all of the what about all the energy consumption of Bitcoin? Well, Parker has the answer for you in one brief, straight to the point article that gets to the core of the issue very, very effectively, as only a proper Bitcoiner could. And I'm delighted to take this opportunity to announce I have sources that inform me that Parker is working on publishing this series of essays into a book, Gradually, Then Suddenly. So I really look forward to that coming out. I think it's going to be an excellent addition to the library of all Bitcoiners. So Parker, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me and for the kind words. And I would be remiss to not say that that your book was a key part of my inspiration to write, but mostly for selfish reasons, because once you wrote the Bitcoin Standard, rather than having to explain ideas I couldn't explain as well as you, I could just start handing your book out like candy, and then it helped me leverage my own time better. So I then thought to pay that forward some and write myself also selfishly to help leverage my own time better, so that I didn't have to answer the same question over and over again, but I could provide the article. So thank you for your work, because it was, I think, as you know, it was formative in my own understanding of Bitcoin.
Well, thank you, sir. I should say Parker might be the world record holder for a number of copies of the Bitcoin Standard purchased. I went to Parker's apartment in Austin, Texas once, and it had about 150 copies of the Bitcoin Standard, which is more copies of the Bitcoin Standard than I've ever seen in my life, I think, at the same time in the same place. And he's given them out far and wide in Texas, so much so that actually the governor of Texas got his hands on a copy of that book, and he made me sign that copy for him. I think it was in 2018, and it's been three years later. It found its way to the governor, and I hope he read it and he liked it.
I actually got a chance to meet the governor, and I asked him about it, and he said that he was halfway through. So I can't be certain of that, but that was some confirmation that the book has been cracked.
Well, that's good news. That's good news. Good to know. All right. So tell us a little bit about how you got into Bitcoin, why you found Bitcoin interesting, a little bit about your background before Bitcoin, and why that set you up for getting into Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. So really, my background was in the traditional financial world. Started my career in New York prior to the financial crisis at Deutsche Bank, working in the M&A group. Transitioned from there in 2009, kind of right at the tail end of the crisis, to working in restructuring, both interim management, helping rehabilitate companies that were either in bankruptcy, entering bankruptcy, coming out of bankruptcy, as well as actual creditor side restructurings. And then that ultimately found my way to working at a hedge fund in Dallas that had a pretty broad mandate, kind of global macro, but also similar type stuff that I'd been working on before, all focused on restructurings and then also looking at kind of deep value on the equity side. But when I was working at the hedge fund I was at in Dallas called Hammond Capital, run by an investor named Kyle Bass, I was really doing two paths of research, and one ultimately that led me to your doorstep, Safe, that was also critical in the path. But I was pursuing understanding what would happen when the Fed started to unwind quantitative easing, and going down that rabbit hole, really going deep, trying to understand the mechanisms of how QE worked, why it was quote necessary in the first place. And then in order to understand the operations of what would happen when the Fed started to take those building blocks of liquidity out of the system, what I would expect to happen. Around that same time, I was asked to go due diligence on a company in Canada. It was called BitGold at the time, and reached out to a good buddy of mine, Will Cole. I was not yet involved in Bitcoin, and I asked him if it had anything to do with Bitcoin, and he looked at it quickly and told me no, but that he knew somebody that that understood gold very well, and ended up connecting me with Safe. Safe helped unlock my mental blocks around gold, and it was like zero to gold to Bitcoin. Once I started to understand gold, then Bitcoin made a lot of sense to me, or I was able to see Bitcoin as a result of that. And being able to pair that with all of the research that I was doing on the Fed and quantitative easing, and then what would happen when the Fed started to unwind quantitative easing, it became very clear to me that that not only did Bitcoin work, but it was also the solution to the problem of central banks printing trillions of dollars. And that's a problem that most people don't, you know, readily appreciate is one that they have and suffer from. Bitcoiners obviously do, but kind of comparing or combining those two paths of research then led me to want to work on Bitcoin full time. Like I recognize why Bitcoin was valuable, how it worked, and recognizing that it's not in a vacuum, that that we're all living in a system that's broken, and that if it's not Bitcoin, it has to be something else. But that once you understand kind of the construction of the Bitcoin network, why Bitcoin's valuable, you see it as the solution to that problem, that biggest problem.
Yeah, I think the story of Bitgold, which later rebranded as Gold Money, is really a great way to explain Bitcoin. I think my own path to Bitcoin came through the journey of trying to build something like Bitgold back in 2011, 2012. I thought, you know, I had all of these ideas about hard money and gold and why gold is better money than fiat. And I thought, you know, what the world really needs is an alternative to central banks where you can just transact with gold. And we got to make gold digital. You make gold digital, you build an app like PayPal or Venmo, but with, you know, with a bunch of gold at its bottom rather than a central bank settlement system. And it seems like a great idea because, you know, inflation is obviously always a problem. It varies to an extent. That right now, people think inflation is a problem. Back in 2011, people didn't. But in reality, I think it's been a problem now and in 2011 and pretty much all the time since 1914, really. And so gold is the obvious solution. And something like Bitgold is the obvious solution in the digital era. And there was something earlier called eGold, which was established in the 1990s, where that was, again, the idea, you know, there were digital certificates for ownership of physical gold that was owned by a company. But that was shut down by the government. And then with Bitgold and with the, and, you know, I tried to do something similar, but at a very embryonic stage, I fortunately realized that this is basically unworkable, that there's no way that this can work out. Well, it was an early stage, but unfortunately not early enough because I spent a lot of those years being considering that this is going to be, this is going to be the future and it's not going to be Bitcoin. Bitcoin is unworkable. Bitcoin is, digital and tulips and governments are going to ban it. But then you see the attempt to try and make those things work with gold, and you can see why they won't work, because basically governments are able to control all the mechanisms for the settlement of gold, so there can't be price discovery, there can't be settlement, there can't be a free market in the trading of gold as long as governments have the ability to control it. And then once you understand that, you then see the value proposition of Bitcoin. You see why Bitcoin's decentralization is so important and why it's really so unique, because if it can manage to provide digital hard money for people, it's basically like building something like Bitgold, but without the government being able to control the final layer of settlement, which is what's really powerful about it.
Yeah, it was really, for me in that path, it was interesting because when I look back, I, sometimes have a hard time explaining why I was hung up on certain things. But I remember very consciously thinking, as soon as gold started to make sense to me, and I'm very sympathetic to the gold bugs that can't see Bitcoin. But that I was thinking, oh, okay, maybe, thinking about Bitgold and thinking about gold, maybe we take Bitcoin and we put it on top of gold. And, Bitcoin is the mechanism by which things are transferred and gold is like the underlying hard asset. And I was like trying to wrap my head. There was, it was like that typical trope that people that like gold is like, oh, it's physical. But then I after probably like 15 or 30 days of thinking about this on and off, I was like, oh no, the Bitcoin is the scarcity. Like it's all wrapped up in one. It has it's perfected the element of scarcity relative to gold. And what you were just talking about, the mechanism by which it is settled is also entirely on a decentralized basis. It's like the mic drop, of Bitcoin over gold. And that is also, I use myself as a, what I also recognized in that kind of frame of mind was, if I'm looking at this with a clear set of eyes, both gold and Bitcoin, and I can get to gold and understand why it was money, but then quickly understand why Bitcoin is superior as a form of money, that it ultimately doesn't matter what I believe or what you believe. It's what matters is what the market believes. you know, what the market views as the best store of value. So somebody can be like clinging on to gold and want that to be the form of money for the future. But if more people look at this equation and decide that Bitcoin is the consensus, that everybody's going to get dragged along. But those were really formative kind of thought processes for me in getting to Bitcoin as well.
Yeah. So getting back to your earlier work, I think we should would be good to spend some time discussing how things have evolved in the last, what was it now, 4 or 5 years on your work on unwinding QE, because it's been, I mean, it's been, you know, it's maybe since 2010 that people have been expecting quantitative easing to unwind. And here we are 12 years later. And, you know, we've been in this endless tease of the Fed saying they will, but they won't, but then they do, but then they don't. So what are your thoughts on that now? How do you think things are going to go? Are they actually going to tighten, or are they just going to make noises about tightening?
So the conclusion that I came to in 2016, 2017, which really, you know, kind of was core to leading me to Bitcoin, was that that quantitative easing can't work, not in the way that the Fed believes it works. Can't work, doesn't work, and ultimately functionally dictates that there will be more QE in the future. And that the way that, as I was going down that Fed QE rabbit hole, the way I started seeing the field, or the way I now describe it to folks, is thinking about the total amount of debt that exists in a system versus the actual dollar. Like if I'm talking about the US, but it applies more broadly to all central banks. But I'll talk about kind of my own path of research and how I think about the Fed. It is the largest, but the mechanisms are the same. Is that what is the total amount of debt in a system? And then what are the total number of dollars that can satisfy the payment of those debts? And that when I was looking at, I was basically looking at what it was in 2016-17, and then what it was prior to the financial crisis. And so prior to the financial crisis, there was about $52 trillion in dollar denominated debt. And that's just vanilla debt, fixed liability, fixed maturity, not getting into like unfunded pension liabilities, not getting into CDOs or CDS or synthetics, that it's just, you know, mortgages, credit card debt, student loans, federal debt, state debt, local debt, corporate debt, bonds, you know, kind of fixed liability, fixed maturity. $52 trillion of dollar-denominated debt in the U.S. credit system, and that's a number that the Fed publishes in their Z1 report on the financial accounts of the United States. At the time, the banks in total only had $350 billion of cash. Both reserves at the Fed as well as hard currency in vaults. And the way that I looked at that was that that every dollar had essentially been lent out 160 times over, 150 to 160 times over. And that what the Federal Reserve did through QE was they inserted a lot more base money. They there was way too much debt. And there was an insufficient number of dollars to pay all those debts. And they essentially delevered the system by injecting $3.6 trillion over the course of 4 to 5 years of new base money. That new $3.6 trillion allowed not only for the existing debts to be paid, for that money to cycle through and kind of like alleviate the starvation of the funding mechanism within the credit system, but it is also designed to expand the credit system. So when they injected $3.6 trillion, people say that reserves aren't lent, but you know, practically speaking, that's not true. That now today the credit system has grown from $52 trillion to, I believe it's between 85 and 88 trillion. So we basically started in 2008 with a credit problem, and then the credit system has metastasized, but that only happens as a function of QE. And so when I kind of connected that in 2006 or 2016 and 17, I realized that the Fed might believe that they can unwind QE, but that they never can, because not only are the dollars that they inserted necessary to service existing debt levels, but that it's also necessary to continue to expand the credit system. And if the credit system is not expanding, it literally starts to feed on itself and will get into a point of like free fall collapse if the Fed doesn't pump more dollars. And so like when I look at the situation today, obviously 2016-17, I realized they're going to have to do this again. They didn't fix any problem. It was you who, I think, you know, in some of our discussions, we were kind of creating an analogy. It's one that I use, believe I credit. If I don't, I'm crediting it now. Kind of comparing heroin or QE more to heroin than an antibiotic, that the more that's applied to a system, the more dependent the patient becomes or the drug addict becomes on that, and it can't actually solve the problem. And so in 2016, 2017, I realized they're going to have to do this again, and they're going to, like, it is inevitable. It's not a probability. It's not a possibility. It is a certainty. And that will always be true for that reason, that the actual mechanism of inserting base money is designed to induce credit system expansion, basically first stabilize credit system, then induce credit system expansion. But then as there's more debt, it needs actually more dollars to be able to support it. So what happened is consistent with what I would have expected to happen in 2018. They started unwinding QE. Over about 2 years, they took out about $700 billion of the $3.6 trillion, and they basically walked into a buzzsaw. In September 2019, the repo markets broke, and it broke because they were taking out the liquidity from the system, and it was basically creating a run on certain areas of the banking system as well as the credit markets. So when I fast forward today, it is the same exact thing. The Fed realizes they're in a catch-22. Inflation is running rampant at the same time that financial assets are at all-time highs, and they need to do something to try to bring down inflation. But they're in the same exact kind of set of circumstances where as soon as they, if they do start to tighten, which they probably will, in terms of like actually taking dollars out, that they're going to wind back up in the same exact place where they were in September of 2019, where they literally break the system. I don't think they have that appreciation because they look around and they think that the market is flooded with liquidity. But even today, if there's 85 to 88 trillion of dollar denominated debt, the base money is about 8.4 trillion. They've massively expanded the base money, but each dollar is still lent out 10 to 1 in terms of base money to the credit size of the credit system. So I think that they will attempt it because they almost, in their world, prefer to be reactive. They want it to be obvious that they need to quote, do more of this, and that they will try, but that there are certain mechanisms that will prevent that from being sustained in any, you know, meaningful way.
Yeah, I think I agree too. I think ultimately the political pressures that they face from raising rates are far larger than the political pressures that they would face from a small increase in CPI measures, which at the end of the day is a manipulated measure. It's a government statistic. It's far easier to lie with CPI than it is to destroy the financial system by raising rates and putting a lot of banks out of business and costing a lot of very powerful, very rich people a lot of money. Like, it's just, it's a no-brainer. You know, lie with CPI or destroy your political constituencies and your donors and the people who put you in power. It seems like the balance there definitely swings in the favor of more inflation. And I think inflation is nowhere near a big enough economic problem where the Fed is going to have its hands forced by like populist uproar. We're still nowhere near the point where you know, people aren't out in the streets demonstrating about inflation. People aren't calling for you know, all kinds of radical measures to stem inflation. We're nowhere near that. In fact, a lot of people don't believe that inflation is a problem. A lot of people think, all right, well, you know, it's on, all right, 6%, but that's because it's a pandemic, it's a supply chain, it's this and this and that. So, you know, clearly, if you understand how things work, you know that monetary policy is the driver of inflation, but not enough people believe that. And I don't think there's enough political pressure on the Fed to act as if that is the case, so far, at least. So they've got plenty of runway, I think, in terms of you know, having a little bit more inflation, blaming it on supply chain, blaming it on OPEC, blaming it on all kinds of different things. And before it becomes a real political liability. And even when it becomes a real political liability, I mean, so what? You know, the Democrats don't get elected in the midterms, or Biden doesn't get elected over the next presidency. You know, that's something that it's a sacrifice the Fed is probably willing to make. They're not the ones that are going to be suffering from it. So there is, there's, of course, the Federal Reserve is extremely politicized, but it's not entirely subject to the presidency or to Congress. It's kind of its own thing, and it has its own political pressures. And I think it's more likely that they're going to probably not tighten in any meaningful way. But what do you expect is going to happen to inflation in that case? Do you think it'll continue to remain in this kind of, you know, CPI in the single digits, or is CPI going to break out, or is or are prices going to just increase massively even as CPI continues to stay low? How do you see it working out?
Yeah, I think that my framework for thinking about this is that you know, when the Fed attempts to tighten, that they that is inherently deflationary. That it is essentially starts to put a stranglehold or impair the impulse to expand credit. And that as there are fewer dollars to fund existing debts, then like the initial move is some kind of deflationary impact. But that realistically is fundamentally only temporary, because not only does the Fed need to actually print more money. And the way I think about it is there is likely political pressure, but it's also their very existence that they that the credit system and how their whole entire structure of how they derive power and how their system works is anchored to the allocation of credit, such that if something puts that entire credit system at risk, their very survival, they're going to err on the side of preserving that structure. And if they actually took the dollars out of the system, that system would collapse. And that would actually, while like maybe an initial move might be deflationary, it's going to be extremely inflationary because the actual economic coordination function is going to break down. And what that means is the things that you actually need, like food, water, basic healthcare, are going to become more and more scarce relative to money. And that is what actually induces like the core underlying, whether it's CPI or just, you know, kind of as Saylor describes it, as a vector of the things that you actually consume, that if they're becoming more and more scarce, that and money is becoming more and more abundant, then it is actually the function of printing that money, which they've done over 40, 50 years, but will have to continue to do, that causes further breakdown in the economic structure. So I think the trap for, say, like a lot of macro investors is they look for cause and effect. Well, if the Fed is going to take dollars out, that's deflationary, so there's going to be deflationary pressures. But what they don't realize is that even in a scenario where the credit system collapses, that breaks down economic coordination and goods, like real good delivery, gets impaired in that scenario, or in the scenario where they print a lot of money. And so it's like, damn if you do, damn if you don't. At this point, they're so far beyond repair, and so much harm has been done that you can't put that genie back in the bottle. It's like the way that the Fed works is putting money into the system is like pulling on a thread. Trying to take it out is like pushing a thread, and that once it's there, you know, it's permanently altered the financial structure, and created imbalance, sustained imbalance, and that it really just at a fundamental level screws up the underlying economic balance. And so my view of it is that kind of everything that the Fed has done over the last 40 or 50 years has led to this point, and it's kind of like the history is already written, and we're just kind of playing it out now. So initially, you know, when they take dollars out of the system, yes, like it's going to be deflationary to financial assets, but that's not going to, you know, that's not going to make the scenario of getting more goods out to market that people need today any more abundant. Like if anything, it's going to go the opposite way. So I think people could, you know, immediately see some like change in the trend of inflation, but it will continue to go one way despite whatever the Fed does.
Yeah, I think it's difficult for me to disagree. So moving on to the main course, how does Bitcoin fix this?
Yeah, I think Bitcoin definitely fixes this. You know, I think we've had discussions about this in the past. I think that that ultimately, you know, we've shifted away from a world in which base money is what coordinates economic activity. And, you know, I think if we went back, and you're more of a student of history than I am, but if we looked at the evolution of banking, that it existed kind of as one sector of the economy that sat on the side and kind of competed for capital with, you know, all other sectors of the economy, and that kind of over the course of the last century, the monetary capital went from being distributed to really being captive and monopolized by the banking sector. And that what that also then allowed to happen was for the base money to take a backseat in terms of being the primary engine of economic coordination, shifting towards the allocation of credit being that. And that the allocation of credit today is orders of magnitude greater than actual base money, you know, fundamentally coordinating economic activity. And I think that how Bitcoin solves this at a fundamental basis by not only representing sound money and being able to, you know, kind of more clearly communicate price signals, that thing that you talked about before of decentralizing the mechanism by which currency settles will shift us back to a world where base money is the primary coordination engine and all the sectors of the economy can basically communicate and trade directly with each other rather than having to go through the banking system. And like the way that I visualize it is that, you know, we went from a world where the banking system sat kind of horizontally as any other sector of the economy. And now it is the lifeblood. It's sitting as the beating heart that everything has to go into the banking center and out back out to some other area of the economy, and we'll disintermediate that. And that as part of that process, base money will be, you know, Bitcoin will be used for people to trade, you know, directly in commerce. And we'll all be able to rely on the fact that there can't be somebody in some faraway off land printing money and destroying our savings. And that what we'll get from that is far greater economic imbalance, because it doesn't mean that there won't be credit systems. Doesn't mean that there won't be expansions in the credit system that are unsustainable, but that what Bitcoin does beautifully because of its fixed and inelastic supply is that, and we see this in how the Bitcoin rises and corrects and rises and corrects, that as soon as imbalance appears in the Bitcoin monetary system or economic system, it quickly gets eliminated. It quickly gets eliminated by the free market. And that the sooner we can recognize those imbalances as a function of price, that it actually eliminates long-term imbalances. And that's what that long-term imbalance of sustaining it, which the Fed actively promotes knowingly or unknowingly, that's what ultimately creates fragility. And so Bitcoin, by having that inelastic supply, by being the primary way in which economic coordination will happen, and that it will be the marginal price setter, and that its supply can't be manipulated, will eliminate this really structural fragility and imbalance that has formed over 40, 50, 100 years.
I mean, I obviously agree. It's it's a little problematic how much we agree on things, and it's going to be too friendly, I think, perhaps, this discussion. But yeah, I think it's the consequences of imagining the economy being rejigged in this way, where the financial system is no longer on top of everything else, but it's just another industry. And of course, it is important, but you know, sewage is also important, and electricity is important. But they don't give us as much drama in our lives as the financial system. Well, Actually, come to think of it now, electricity is becoming a little bit like the financial system for many people all over the world with all of these new insane things that people are doing to their grids. But of course, it's the same phenomenon, which is central planning. Government mandates forcing you to try different kinds of unworkable sources of energy. But in finance, it's astounding to imagine how different society would be. And I think, one very important point that you and I both keep talking about, and Pierre Rochard is always bringing this up, is the difference between understanding Bitcoin as an investment versus as a saving. Just the idea of savings itself being, the S word coming back into polite society. Well, not so much polite society. Bitcoiners aren't very polite, but coming into the mainstream conversation through impolite Bitcoiners is the fact that, saving is not a bad word. There's nothing wrong with saving. I save, you save, a lot of people save, and we're here and, deal with it. Saving is a normal part of a market economy. So why do you think people hate the concept of saving, or why do they think of it as such a bad thing? What is your take on this, and how does Bitcoin fix this?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Well, I would go back to my own education. So I think, like you, I was, had an economics degree. Well, maybe not from a Western university, but, I have an economics degree from a Western university. When I came to Bitcoin and in many ways through a lot of our discussions, I was trained in this, classical school of like the way that the world is, or they think that it is or should be. And that I really had to unlearn, or I won't say unlearn. I was afforded the benefit of getting to hear a new train of thought, and compare it against something that I had been told to be true or educated on to be true. So I felt like I was in a particularly strong position to be able to say, okay, I've now had real world experience. I've lived through the financial crisis. I've understood economic incentives, worked with a lot of businesses. In school, I was taught one thing, and now I'm learning this Austrian worldview. And which one of these two worlds makes sense to me? And that when I am not prescribing this on like Austrian thinking, but that the way that I started to look at Bitcoin is that there's really two worlds, one in which people either get to control the money supply or one in which they don't. And I know there's a lot more to Austrian economics, but that one is inherently one and the other is inherently the other. And that when I kind of thought about those two contrasts, I look at that world of Keynesian economics now, or even monetarist, and we won't even mention MMT because I don't even believe it's a theory. That what it ultimately amounts to is that there are a group of people, and there probably always will be, that have an inherent bias to think that they know better. That if just they had the ability to allocate more capital than they have otherwise earned, because that's ultimately what it is, that the world would be better, that they could smooth out economic booms and busts, and that there's two realities that are baked into there. They haven't delivered enough value to the world to be able to then allocate, because they haven't honestly earned money. And two, they don't have an appreciation for the complexity of the things that they're screwing with. And that it is a combination of kind of arrogance, naivety, and immaturity, basically. That they think, hey, you know, there's like one way to think about it is there's a landscape of there's a current amount of money that exists in the system and it's distributed in a certain way. And what they're effectively doing through their own economic worldview is saying, just give me more money and I can do this better than the market can. And that when you start to see that there are two alternatives, there's Bitcoin where you can't do that, where essentially nobody gets to print money, that everyone has to acquire capital, both physical capital as well as monetary capital through delivering actual value within an economic system, or there's another system where somebody gets to do that, just not you, but that they get to allocate money how they want, that any average person, average, above average, below average, 9 out of 10 of each one of those distributions, or maybe even 99 out of 100, opts for the system where people can't print money. And so that in my mind, it's like taking the fly out of the ointment, that the actual economic structure becomes impaired because people with less access to information, those sitting around the Federal Reserve table and those in Washington, D.C. And when I talk about less access to information, it is, you know, an auto mechanic knows a lot more about something in the real economy than anybody at the Fed can ever know, or anybody or most people in Washington, D.C. could ever know. But then you add that up. You're like the auto mechanic, the doctor, the butcher. Everyone has this actual information, the builder, that people in some faraway land can't know and can't set prices on. And so that the thing that dictates it is this audacity that they could allocate capital better than the market, which is just fundamentally true because they actually have less information, like a tiny, tiny fraction of information of the market. And that the way that Bitcoin fixes it is simply by eliminating that ability. You know, it's like basically, it's not the equivalent of like the kid touching the hot stove. It's like the kid that keeps doing something that you don't want them to do. And rather than putting them in timeout, making sure they can never do that again, you just let them continue to do that. And that the people that decide to opt into the Bitcoin world basically look at it and say, yeah, that system is screwed up. And I'm not going to let those people in a far off land continue to screw with the value that I've already delivered, because it will end badly.
Yeah, I think this is really a crucial point that people miss, which is they think government is just adding to the stock of capital when we have expansionary monetary policy. Like we just made a whole bunch of extra money and we can hand it out, and then we have more investment taking place. But of course, that's nonsense because, you know, money itself is not a resource. It's a claim on resource. And when you print more money, you're not making more resources. You're making more claims on the same resources. And so you're leading people to imagine that they have more claims on resources than they actually do. Because, you know, according to your calculations, you think that right now, you know, my money can buy me enough capital to, say, build 10 houses. But because you're getting cheap credit, more people are getting their money for those houses. And so when they start bidding on the market for those houses, the price for the resources that go into making the houses, you're going to find that you're unable to finish the 10 houses. And that's the essence of the Austrian story on malinvestment. So first of all, it's not a free lunch. You're just redistributing the existing lunch. And secondly, and I think this is, so there are a lot of Keynesians and a lot of central bank shills who will present this as, you know, well, this is good because it leads to more investment. And even if some of the investment doesn't work out, all right, maybe a couple of people are going to make mistakes in this. It's still worth it because, you know, you're getting more houses built, you're getting more construction jobs, you're getting more workers working, and you're moving the wheel of the economy because, you know, that's the kind of city Keynesian metaphor of how a market works. That if you just get, you know, if you crank the wheel a few times, it starts getting going, then the engine will start going. And the car will start moving. But of course, what they miss is the issue of calculation and allocation and the problem of central planning in the capital allocation. And that's really the essence of the problem of central banking, which is that when you're allowing the central bank to expand credit, then it is the one that's assigning capital to investors, and you've subverted and shortcutted effectively the real process that allows for capital to be allocated in markets in a productive way, which is the market process where everybody's market input is, you know, out there to be judged and tested by the market itself. The market will decide if you're a good investor in building houses or if you're good at building, you know, factories for shoes or whatever it is. You need to allocate that capital in a way that covers your expenses. If you don't do that, you go out of business. And so everyone, as you were saying, you know, the distributed knowledge that everybody has, the little tiny pieces of knowledge that allow you in your own position, in your own business, you know, if you're in the shoe industry, you know that this is what I need to do in order to make this profitable. All of that is takes a second place to the first thing that decides the allocation of capital, which is politics, which is government, which is the central bank. And that's really why so much capital is misallocated, because it's central planners that are allocating it. Of course, on top of the fact that, you know, you have inflation that is constantly burning the capital in people's cash balances, preventing them from saving and therefore forcing them to go out and take on more risk with their capital, which results in a lot of capital loss. And it results in, you know, you need to make a return, even if it's a nominally positive return, but a negative return in real terms. That still makes sense in a fiat world because it beats sitting on cash and having a real negative return, but a nominal zero return.
Yeah, one thing I would add, kind of like to that idea, is, you know, thinking about it as, imagine there's a world where there's 100 units of currency and there's 100 people and they each have one. And then, you know, because you asked the question about, you know, the savings idea, and that, you know, basically those 100 people that make up that economy that each have, you know, it's not, you know, indicative of a realistic scenario, but just to make a point that that those 100 people each have 1% of the monetary capital, and they get to decide at what time and how to price things that they value in the world. And that is inherently savings. And that, you know, what the Fed and the central banks do is they basically say, hey, you're not spending money when we want you to, or on what we want you to. And we think that we know better than you. So we're going to create 50 new units and we're going to allocate them arbitrarily. And they have mechanisms by which to do that, but assume that suddenly 25 people, you know, now have 2 units of currency or 3 units of currency, and 75 have one. Now those 25 have a disproportionate ability to influence the economic structure than the other 75. And that is essentially what happens, that there are more units, the distribution is not even, and that fundamentally alters the economic system because it distorts the price signals based on altering forever the distribution of who holds the monetary capital in a way that is inconsistent with how that economic system got to the point that it was at. And that, you know, one way that I think about the savings equation, which I think is, you know, it seems paradoxical, but we all, like, individually know the benefit of savings, or even people that don't save, you know, understand that they probably should have saved, that it creates stresses in their lives not to, but then kind of on a system-wide, somehow we live in this net debtor situation, which is only kind of practically speaking able to exist in the way that it does because the Fed consistently prints more money or digitally creates it. The people who are pedantic always say that the Fed doesn't print money, which it technically doesn't. The Treasury does, but the Fed creates dollars. That in Bitcoin, by having a fixed supply of 21 million, I kind of visualize it as, imagine there's already 21 million out there. It's like no more Bitcoin can ever be saved. It's always being saved. It's just being saved by different people at different points in time for different time horizons or time continuums. But that the actual incentive to save, having a form of money that can't be printed, will actually induce more individual savers, while in aggregate, nobody can save more money. But that what that then causes is more and more people have smaller units of the money. That economic system naturally has more balance, and more people having more savings, you know, essentially not being caught in a scenario where, you know, in March of 2020, when they shut down the economic system, there's 50% of the world that doesn't have savings. So they can't survive for a month without clipping a paycheck. They're basically indebted to the system. That in Bitcoin, and it's something that might not be intuitive, but that as a whole, as a system, you can't save more than 21 million Bitcoin and it only transfers, but that mechanism itself will induce billions of people that don't have savings today to be incentivized to save. And then the result of it is a more balanced economic system.
Yeah, I think people massively underestimate just how important saving is. I mean, economic education is generally militating against saving. And so people don't really think about it. They think, well, that money is just sitting there. It's doing nothing. And this is a famous Keynesian, famous quote by Keynes that, you know, people are sociopaths if they don't spend their money, because, you know, you spend your money, you put people to work, you put food on other people's table, and you get to enjoy life, you get to live a little. Whereas if you're a sociopath, you just sit on the money. So there's this idea that you don't, if money is sitting there, then it's not doing anything. It's useless. And it completely misses the point of what money is. Like, that's money's job. Money's job is to sit there looking pretty in somebody's balance sheet. In fact, at every single moment, money is in somebody's balance sheet, sitting there doing nothing. It's transferred from one person to the other. And that's effectively an instantaneous moment. You know, it's mine up until a point, and then it's yours, but it's sitting in mine and then it's sitting in yours. So that's really all that money does. Money just sits there, but it's a way of protecting yourself from the future. It's a way for providing for yourself into the future. And I think, you know, the point that I keep emphasizing in the fiat standard, and it's one of the central themes of the book, is that people massively underestimate just how important it is for us to have a reliable way for providing for our future. Because when we do, the uncertainty of the future declines, and then our life becomes far more concerned with the future. Our actions, our everyday interactions and everything that we do becomes far less or far more oriented to the future. And that's basically the process of lowering our time preference. So the ability to save, and I think this is the point, I'm the first to make this argument, is that our ability to save itself is what lowers our time preference. When we have a mechanism for storing value into the future, you know, when we invented money, when we started using things as money, the more we use those things and the better those things were at carrying value into the future, the more we are the more we feel secure about the future and certain about the future, and the less uncertain we are, and therefore the more we start thinking of the future. And I think this is something that we have been as a human species, you know, we've constantly been making our money better and harder, and that's constantly been giving us a lower time preference and making us save more, making us accumulate capital more, making us think about the future more. And it's, you know, if this is correct, if what I'm saying is correct, you would expect to see interest rates drop over time. And in fact, we do see that. We see interest rates generally declining over time. But if that's also correct, then we see that in the early 20th century, humanity basically took a massive civilizational U-turn, basically, where instead of continuing to progress with harder money and more savings and more investment into the future and more concern for the future and a lower time preference, we move toward a much easier money and therefore higher time preference, less provision for the future, more short-termist actions, more fixation on the present, more impulsiveness. And I think we see that all around us. We see it in the entire planet, everywhere around us. People are, I think, more short-termist today than their ancestors were probably 100 years ago. And I don't think you can argue that that is completely unrelated to the fact that their ancestors 100 years ago had a hard money they could use for saving, or let's say 110 years ago, because by 1922, you know, we were already on fiat.
Yeah, I think one other thing that that plays into that same theme is the idea of like what does savings actually represent, and that in a world where they can print money, it functionally means something different in a world where they can't. But if we think about the world where they can't print money, then what monetary savings represents is the amount that someone's produced for others that they have not yet consumed from others, right? And that incentive where you are incented to actually defer consumption means that you've produced more for others around you than you've demanded from them. And that there's, I think, you know, culturally something very, very productive or aligned about that. When everyone is incented to deliver value to other people and consume less and less value from them in the present, that aligns all economic interests and incentives. And that when you actually have the reverse, when you have a money that loses value, you're actually incented to do the opposite. You're actually incented to consume more of people than you actually produce over time. And that when you start to compound that over, hundreds of millions of people and billions, if not trillions of economic decisions over time, you start to get really bad outcomes in one scenario. And I think it's akin to you deliver value to somebody today, and then some, you know, when the government can print money or just living in an easy money world, however you want to think about it, you've delivered value in the past up to the present. And then somebody puts a gun to your head and says, spend that value, spend that value, spend that value. Because it's going to purchase less and less and less and less and over time. So it's like consume from someone else now, or figure out ways to get value or to get monetary capital without actually delivering long-term value. So the just flipping the script of those incentives, I think also contributes to that thinking about the future and planning for the future and kind of having an entirely different mindset to how you approach your day-to-day of, you know, kind of actually delivering value versus just making money.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely. All right, let's get into some more of your pieces on gradually then suddenly. Well, the first one is gradually then suddenly. You want to tell us why you chose that title and what that signifies and how it's relevant to Bitcoin and the economics of Bitcoin?
Yes. It was originally derived from a Hemingway statement. I think the actual statement was first slowly, then all at once, or something along that. And kind of over time, people kind of just, it evolved into gradually and suddenly. So it wasn't part of my original, I could never claim original thought, but it was a nod to Hemingway. What he was describing was the process of going bankrupt. First slowly, then all at once, gradually, then suddenly. And that the point being that that when someone winds up bankrupt, whether it's an individual, whether it's a company, or whether it's a country, or the equivalent, even if a country can't, formally file for bankruptcy, that it didn't happen at the point of filing or the point in which it became readily apparent that they were actually insolvent, that there wasn't a way out, that it was a culmination of many decisions in the past, that they happened gradually and then they figured it out suddenly. And that it's not only how kind of individuals and companies go bankrupt, it's also, in my mind, how currencies collapse. that what's happening all over the world, that's happened historically. I think you included this in the Bitcoin standard, or maybe separately shared it with me, but like all the episodes of hyperinflation that have existed on the fiat standard, that if you look at currencies collapsing, and typically these days we look at them relative to the dollar, but it will happen to the dollar at some point too, in my view, that there's a moment where you see like, you know, the currency degrading over time, and that might be felt just in kind of a local market, you know, CPI measure, but then something happens where confidence is broken, and there aren't actually underlying monetary principles or monetary properties that back a fiat currency, and that you see this sudden breakdown in confidence of the currency. We've seen it in Turkey, we saw it in Venezuela. I believe we've already seen it in Argentina. That there is a sudden move, and then history, you know, like everything is history from there. And so the gradually then suddenly moniker was talking about, you know, kind of, you know, not just to the process by which people go bankrupt. It's the process by which countries go bankrupt. It's the process by which currencies fail. But it's also then the way that people come to understand Bitcoin, that they're kind of, you know, along a path. It's not making sense. They're consuming content, going down a rabbit hole. And then some idea clicks in their mind, that somebody says something that unlocks something, and they, like, Bitcoin does not magically become intuitive to them overnight, but something happens generally suddenly where something that they couldn't see is now seeable, and that they recognize that Bitcoin isn't a Ponzi scheme, that it's not digital beanie babies, that it's actually, you know, foundational, fundamentally revolutionary, and that it's solving a problem that most people are walking around the world not realizing that they have. And so kind of for all of those reasons, I felt like gradually then suddenly would be a good title. It was part, you know, it was kind of probably descriptive of my own path to Bitcoin. I know kind of immediately where I was when, like, you know, somebody said something and like my eyes were opened, and I was like, ah, this is, I get it. You know, it was going out on a ledge, and starting to understand it and recognize there was something there. And then, you know, certain key ideas just unlocked the last remaining blocks. And then I started filling in gaps from there.
Yeah, I think it's a very common experience among Bitcoiners. As you start to, you know, everybody starts off being a skeptic and a smart ass who knows exactly why Bitcoin won't work, even though they haven't spent 15 minutes looking at the code or reading the white paper. Everybody has their reasons, which they know. And then, you know, as reality begins to chip away at your, pretty self-centered and egotistical idea that, oh, well, it's not going to work because of this or that. And yet it continues to work, and it continues to work. You start, you know, gradually succumbing to the idea, well, what if it does work? What if it does work? And then, like an avalanche, you know, there's one little rock that falls, and then it triggers the whole thing. You know, once it clicks, okay, so that's how it works. And then you realize that maybe it can work. And then you start thinking about the implications of it. And yeah, you just, like an avalanche, you fall, or, you know, you slide into the rabbit hole, and then there's just no rescuing you. And then soon enough, you know, you're on Twitter with laser eyes, listening to the Bitcoin Standard podcast and grilling steaks and trolling Fed employees for fun on Twitter.
Yeah, one way that I describe it is, it's like there's three states in that I view in Bitcoin, where there's two people, and they're both staring at the same thing, this thing Bitcoin. And one person sees the Sistine Chapel, the masterpiece. Like, this is like, you know, this is the answer to the like one of the most fundamental and foundational problems that impacts, you know, the widest range of people. And then there's another person, a no coiner, sitting there looking at the exact same equation. Let's call him Warren Buffett. And he's looking at it and he can't see it. It's just a blank screen. He's like, what are you looking at? Like, you're saying this is the Sistine Chapel. I'm just seeing, you know, a blank white screen. And then some idea clicks, and it it doesn't immediately go to the Sistine Chapel. It can't, because that can only happen over time, but that it goes from a blank screen to a silhouette emerging from the fog, where, and that's the hardest leap, to go from like staring at this and making no sense to see, connecting some idea that made sense, so that then it's like, oh, like there's something here. And that once you get to that point of like starting to see the outline or the silhouette, that the point of getting to the masterpiece is inevitable. Like you have to like connect some idea that opens your mind up to the possibility that, you know, we're not all just hallucinating here. And then as soon as you do, as soon as some idea hits home or connects to unlock a mental block, your inevitable path down the rabbit hole into laser eyes, you know, it's basically, it was completed at that moment of going from zero to maybe, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, some of the other gems from that series, Bitcoin can't be copied. I think you did a great job there of explaining why Bitcoin can be copied, and it's a great thing to send to people who tell you, well, you know, there's 16,000 digital currencies now, and they're all like Bitcoin, so that makes Bitcoin inflationary. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that I try to be sympathetic, because I was once in that position, right, where it's like a lot of my writing was, what were the things that held me up, and I don't think this was one that like held me up a ton, but it was certainly one where, and I get the question a lot when I'm talking to people, where I go around, you know, whether it's in virtual settings or driving around the state of Texas educating people on Bitcoin, that when I talk about the importance of scarcity, they're like, but if you can create more cryptocurrencies, is it actually scarce? And it's hard to get into the discussion of like, well, the Bitcoin network has no knowledge of all these other 1,000 cryptocurrencies, so it's irrelevant to the Bitcoin network. Like, you can't just jump right there, because they don't have the monetary context. And that I think that there are two things that make like sense to someone from a common sense perspective. It's that that the money doesn't grow on trees, and they're there's no such thing as a free lunch, where, you know, kind of connecting those ideas into, you know, yes, everyone would like to be able to print money, but that's not the way that it works. And that one of the ideas that I connect for people in this piece is that you can copy Bitcoin's code base, that many people have, more people will. It's really driven by the ability or the wanting of an ability to print money, but that they can't copy Bitcoin's monetary properties, and that there's really, to, you know, they can copy the code base, but Bitcoin's not valuable just because software code says it is. It's actually, there's a monetary system that's far beyond an actual piece of software, but that it's also self-referencing. That there's two key ideas. There's that an optimal monetary policy, and what I mean by that is, one, like, if you could find any form of money, you would want one that had the lowest rate of change, and that zero is the lowest rate of change. You don't want one that declines in supply. You don't want one that increases, because then it introduces some arbitrary mechanism by which that might happen, that the optimal state is zero. And that, and there was an idea that you had in the Bitcoin standard that I, if I didn't included in the piece, it was certainly something that informed the view, which was this idea that an economy can expand to I think the quote was something along the lines of an economy can expand to a size, you know, kind of consistent with the number of people that are willing to use a common currency. That like that common use of a common currency is what allows economies to scale. And that that if you think about the world, virtually 99.9% of all people, they only interact with one form of money. And that's not by coincidence. That's actually core to the problem that Bitcoin solves. And so if you start to understand that, yes, money, you know, despite the world that we live in today, money doesn't grow on trees, and that what everyone is actually doing when they're creating copies of Bitcoin is trying to print their own money, and that you can't copy Bitcoin's monetary properties, and that you actually only need one form of money, that it's actually because Bitcoin already exists, that no other currencies will ever be able to achieve a better state because Bitcoin's already achieved it. And then that eliminates or obsoletes the very need for whatever currency that you've created. And that the way I, in a personal setting, the way I'll usually describe it is, imagine, you know, you create a copy of Bitcoin and call it, you know, SafeCoin or ParkerCoin, say they're only going to be over 21 million. That doesn't mean that that will be the case. It will have no credibility. It's not just that software code says it, it's that it's actually credibly enforced without the need for trust. And then just imagine that ParkerCoin is called Ethereum, because that's essentially what it is. And so it's kind of that self-referencing equation of, you know, the more that the greater the Bitcoin scales, the more people that adopt it, that monetary policy, the credibility of the fixed supply gets harder and harder, to change. And if we only need one form of money, then the use for any copies is obsoleted from the very existence of Bitcoin in the first place.
Yeah, I think the point on inflation is a key one, which is that, you know, you want the inflation to be as low as possible. And now with Bitcoin, we already have something that whose inflation rate is extremely low, and it's only going to get lower. And so if you're trying to overtake it with inflation, you can't get lower than Bitcoin. And if you do, you know, you'd have to be centrally planning it in order to be lower than Bitcoin. And then you still have the same problem, the bigger problem of how do you distribute it? If the supply is already fixed and now you only have 1% growth in the supply, then how are you going to have the currency distributed in a fair way? How are you going to have it distributed in a way like proof of work? And that's what you see with, you know, with other digital currencies, is that even if they, you know, for instance, some of the altcoins will tweak their supply now in order to make it so that their supply growth rate is lower than that of Bitcoin. Well, you can do that, but then if you do that, you're getting rid of the decentralization. You're making it very clear that this is a centralized coin that is controlled by a small group of people that can make changes to it. And if they make the supply lower, supply growth rate lower today, they can make it higher tomorrow. And that basically defeats the entire purpose. And this is why you see that many of these altcoins are looking to get into proof of stake, because that really is... that's the best way to run a centralized system. Like if you have a centralized system, yeah, you just do proof of stake. It's much cheaper than doing proof of work. Because for you, if your system is centralized, which is the case with all altcoins, as I think, then proof of stake is just really, it is a waste of electricity in that case. You don't need to do, proof of work is a waste of electricity in that case. You don't need to do proof of work because it doesn't matter what the miners find, you know, the people who run the code, the people who, release the software updates. They have enough of a margin of control, and the process of development is too centralized that they can just decide whatever they want. So if you can change the money supply, regardless of what the proof of work is saying, then you can change everything. There's no need for the proof of work. And I think, you know, a lot of the altcoins, they think that, you know, they're offering an alternative to Bitcoin's proof of work, and they think that that's a selling point, but that's really, that's the exact opposite of a selling point. You know, you're just taking away the value proposition and saying, hey, you know, let's just do fiat. But instead of having a central bank that, you know, at least needs to get on TV and in front of Congress and justify itself, let's just have a bunch of programmers in charge of this.
Yeah. And I think like something that I've found, at least, that's hard for people to understand is this idea, like there's only like that you only need, it's kind of remarkable because when you tell someone that you only need one currency, even though they only use one currency in their day-to-day lives, it's hard for them to somehow wrap their brain around that. But then the idea that is, if there actually is a currency, which there is, and it's called Bitcoin, that has a credibly enforced fixed supply, it is that fact which ensures that there will not be any others. Because that system is also global and permissionless. So anybody can opt into it. And that, you know, this was an idea that I think very early on, I think it was certainly in the Bitcoin standard, but you helped connect me with, which is if there is an option that is more secure and that is larger, that is always going to be preferential to every literal individual in an A/B test, so long as they can access it, right? Because local markets matter. If nobody in your local economy accepted Bitcoin and you were saving in it, it doesn't do you as good. So it's not like avoiding that reality, but that will happen over time. But that if it's an A-B test, I've produced value and I need to store it, I'm always going to be incentivized to save it in a monetary network that's more secure. And that opens my range of choice up to more trading partners, and that we see that in practice. But that is a hard idea for people to understand, is that the mere fact that Bitcoin has solved that problem of credibly enforcing a fixed supply, one that has a zero rate of change, that it obsoletes, that no other currency will ever be able to achieve it. Because another idea that is generally intuitive to people is that new technologies generally don't displace, quote, old technologies. And we'll, won't be calling Bitcoin old, but just in this circumstance or this example, unless by just being marginally as good. Like, there is a reality that every other cryptocurrency cannot actually solve the same problem as Bitcoin already did. But that if the best that you could ever do was match it, deliver a form of money that has a zero rate of change that nobody can print, that does not induce people to switch, to change their behavior, to upgrade from the horse to the car. You know, like if you were like, hey, I've got this really good horse, and there's this new horse, and he runs like just as fast, and he's a little bit older, like, I'm not going to change which horse I'm riding. But if you deliver a car, it can go faster and get you to places, and provide a lot of other advantages, you're going to change. If in this equation, it is the best that any other cryptocurrency could ever do for me is deliver the same thing that Bitcoin is already delivering to me, I have no incentive, especially given that it's less secure, and we can see it in, the amount of actual hash rate, in terms of the security of it, but then adoption as well, that it's like, for people that actually look for the signal, it is like blatantly obvious, that Bitcoin is that larger network that's more secure. The people who claim that there's more devs working on Ethereum, they're just idiots. But when people look for the actual signal, they find that. But there are ideas baked into there that are not intuitive. The idea that we only need one form of money, even though people only use one form of money on a daily basis, and the fact that if we have a form of money that can't be printed, that actually prevents any other currency from achieving that status. Those are hard ideas for people to understand, but I think it's critical to understanding those or to think about it in order to arrive at the conclusion that Bitcoin is actually the solution that a lot of us think it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. You find a lot of confused Keynesian and Marxist thinking among shitcoiner circles. And one great example of that is when people trot out the number of developers working on particular projects as a mention, as a kind of as a way of understanding the merits of the project. And this is really the labor theory of value, the idea that value is determined by how many people work on things. So if 100 chefs make a mud pie, you're obliged to pay enough for that mud pie to justify the work of, to justify the salaries of, and the time of the 100 chefs that worked on it. But of course, that's not the case. It doesn't matter how many chefs and how skilled they are. Nobody wants to eat a mud pie. Nobody's going to pay for it. So value, market value, is not determined by how much labor goes into this. It's determined by subjective valuation of the people who are making the valuation. And so in the case of the altcoins, I think the misconception here a lot of people have is that, they think of the developers as necessarily having to add value. But I think in many cases, the job of a developer is essentially to keep the, basically, a developer on Ethereum is a little bit like, a chemist on Herbalife or a dietitian with Herbalife, in that you have to sell you have to sell things and find more people. And so working on a new project means introducing a new token, means you have to buy some of the original tokens, and it means, bring in a new marketing twist to reach a new audience. So if you're, if you're an influencer, you have an audience, you are bringing those people in to the game, bringing in more bag holders. So it's not exactly a measure of monetary success, if you ask me. But, if you think of it from the perspective of labor theory of value, then yeah, the more people you bring in, then the more valuable the currency.
Yeah, I'm unwilling to accept that there are actually more people working on it, but I think also to that point that, you know, when we just think about productivity from a core, you're actually trying to produce more value with fewer human beings contributing that. That inherently is what productivity is, too. And so, yeah, I think it is probably the single thing that confuses people the most about the sea of noise. It becomes very difficult to you know, a lot of people think that Bitcoin is unknowable, and that, you know, I think one of the great things about the Bitcoin standard, something that I tried to kind of tease out or replicate in my own work, is pulling out the principles that allow people to cast aside all the noise and focus on the signal, to think about the kind of key principles that then allow you to look at things and consume, you know, what otherwise would be an overwhelming amount of information, and be able to assess kind of where signal is or where truth is, that if you just were to go like one by one and get lost in the, you know, in the forest, or the, you know, lost amongst the trees, you would fail to see the forest.
Yeah, very much so. All right. Bitcoin's not too volatile. Why is that the case?
Well, for most people, I feel like volatility is like one of the last, I don't want to say it's an easy one, I feel like, to get people through, but that it is one that trips people up. And I anchor to two points. One, that volatility and storage of value are not the same thing, or they're not mutually exclusive. And that you deal with Bitcoin's volatility. It's like I oftentimes will sit down with people that either manage a lot of money or are of extremely high net worth, and they struggle with Bitcoin's volatility, but they deal with volatility literally every day. And they're very good about dealing with volatility. So if they have a particularly volatile asset, they size it in their portfolio to be an appropriate size, such that, you know, the overall volatility exposure to their aggregate portfolio is muted by everything else that they own. And so it's like, hey, the way that you deal with Bitcoin's volatility is the same way that you deal with volatility today, you know, and that usually does it for them. Like that's an idea that I talk about, but when I talk about it more fundamentally to help them understand Bitcoin's volatility, that's where I think it's actually value additive to people's ability to think about and to see Bitcoin. And it's that idea that people will estimate that there's 150 million people that have Bitcoin today. I would estimate that no more than 10 million people have any material exposure to Bitcoin, which is a significant critical mass of people in its own right. But just using it as an example, we don't know what the actual number is, but let's just play it out in theory. That if 10 million have any material exposure to Bitcoin, and I would define materiality as like 5 to 10% of their assets, that somebody that is worth $1 billion that has $20 worth of Bitcoin doesn't count in my $10 million figure or example. That imagine, you know, those 10 million people are suddenly welcomed by 90 million more people that want to adopt Bitcoin. And that there are 18.9 million Bitcoin that already exist in the world, and there will only ever be 2.1 million more, that you have a perfectly inelastic supply of currency, and you have kind of in total 10x the number of people demanding. And when you face two things at once, which is a increase in adoption by an order of magnitude combined with an inelastic supply, with also the recognition that 9 out of 10 people that are now demanding this are operating with far less access to information than everybody that came before them on average, not to a person, but on average, that volatility is a necessary output of price discovery, of the world adopting a new form of money and increasingly people pricing that good for the first time. That when you have massive adoption waves combined with inelastic supply, combined with asymmetric information in the market, that volatility is natural. But imagine that those you know, of those nine people that adopted, imagine one or two of them figured out the true signal and started accumulating. Well, now the actual base of long-term holders and accumulators has increased to a point of 3x. And that explains kind of these rises and falls of Bitcoin, or rises and corrections, of why the base always resets higher. And that helping people understand what's actually happening behind the volatility or what's causing it then allows them, because the thing that they typically struggle with is saying, like, how can this thing that doesn't operate like money be money if it's so volatile? And the idea is that if we go from 10 million to 100 million, that adoption represents an order of magnitude. And what I just described plays out. Asymmetric information, inelastic supply, and people operating in herds, and most of them buying Bitcoin irrationally, selling Bitcoin irrationally. But even if only a small fraction of people find the real signal, then they turn into long-term adopters. And now the base resets higher because the monetary system is actually larger. Now imagine the next wave. Now imagine going from 100 million to a billion people. The same thing will exist, right? That so long as adoption, marginal adoption, represents orders of magnitude or even multiples of a embedded base, that volatility faced with inelastic supply will always be that natural instance of price discovery operating in that world. But then imagine we get to a billion people, and the top billion, the people with the most access to the information, probably control virtually all the wealth in the world, billion over 8 billion. That imagine the next 100 million. The next 100 million only represent 10%. So this idea that Bitcoin will not be volatile, and it was an idea that Michael Goldstein or Bitstein helped me understand, which was that stability is an emergent property. And then there was another quote that Vijay Boyapati had that was that establishment economists deride the fact that Bitcoin is volatile as if something can go from nothing to a stable form of money without volatility. It is absolutely absurd. That this idea of volatility as a good emerges on the free market is the natural evolution of something becoming a stable form of money. And that when we get to some terminal state where a billion people have Bitcoin, that once that marginal demand represents a percentage, and the reason why I think a billion and not 7 billion is because it also matters to the amount of wealth that those people have, those first billion people that adopt Bitcoin, that at that point that the demand for Bitcoin will truly be marginal, and that volatility will come down as the embedded base represents significantly higher multiples of potential marginal demand.
Yeah, I think also, one way of thinking about it is that basically the volatility is the price you pay for the gains. It's impossible to imagine that Bitcoin is going to keep going up over time at a steady rate. And so it's such very fast growth is going to have to oscillate. And yes, it does, it can be inconvenient for you if you're over leveraged or overexposed. It is a problem, but that's the trick that you need to pull off in order to be able to win in the long term. You don't want to be overexposed in a way that's dangerous, that is going to have you in trouble because of the volatility. So it's a pretty weird thing to object to, because if you don't want it to be volatile, it won't be appreciating this much. What about Bitcoin getting banned? You made a very good case for why Bitcoin cannot be banned.
Yeah, so I always anchor this one. This, there's a lot of them that I anchor to this point, but it's like, I always start with the credible enforcement of a fixed supply of 21 million. And I try to paint a very basic decision tree for people. And in this case of can Bitcoin be banned, it's not to say that certain jurisdictions can't make it more or less comfortable or uncomfortable to privately own Bitcoin. But that first, before you even get to that point, think about, like, is Bitcoin functional as money? because if you started the decision tree, is Bitcoin functional as money? And in my view, which I articulate in this piece, it is only functional as money if it can credibly enforce a fixed supply of 21 million without the need for trust. But if you start to develop an understanding and a framework for why that is possible, and that Bitcoin is functional as money, that only in that circumstance would there be something for government to ban. Because if you looked at that equation and you came to the conclusion that that were not possible, that what you should expect to happen would be that Bitcoin would fall on its own weight and there'd be nothing to ban. So that the question only becomes relevant to you in the case, practically speaking, not only when Bitcoin is actually functional as money or were it to be, but that actually it's working so well as money that it is threatening the global hegemony of the dollar or your local currency. And that a rational economic actor, when posed with that fundamental baseline, which is, I've come to a conclusion as to why Bitcoin is functional as money. And the only circumstance in which my government wants to ban it is if it's working so well that it's threatening their monopoly status over my currency, that the only answer is from a rational economic actor is, regardless for whatever my government does, I need to own that. Because the alternative is, if that reality plays out, that you either have a decision point and you are in maximum control, or you are not. That you either made your decision long ago to be a punching bag and to not hold a currency that you would reasonably expect to have massive increases in purchasing power as global adoption occurred, or be the person who made that decision. And then when the government comes along and says, hey, you can't own Bitcoin here, you now have the ability with, you know, either a small hardware device in your pocket or a set of words in your head to literally take your monetary capital from one jurisdiction to another in a way that previously never existed, that was otherwise not possible. And that the idea that I connect is not, you know, that's the core fundamental. But then when I help connect it kind of at a more macro level, it's thinking about gold. Thinking about prohibition. I think about, you know, the government's made private ownership of gold illegal. Gold did not cease to exist as a phenomenon in the world. Dollars became worth less. Gold held its value, and it continued to exist. You couldn't deny that gold exists. People might be able to make private ownership more or less, kind of easy or difficult. But in your world, anybody in that instance would have wanted to hold gold. Similarly, but differently, when the government tried to ban booze, they weren't able to do it. That Bitcoin, I think about Bitcoin and money as water. Like, we don't get food, healthcare, power, water delivered to our doorsteps every day without the coordination function of money. That humans need money as a basic necessity to maintain a certain level of comfort in their lives. Things that were basically said another way, things that people have taken for granted that are basic necessities only exist via the coordination function of money. And so, you know, when I think about like that as a corollary to the government trying to ban booze, you have something that is far more fundamental and important in people's lives and far harder technically to ban, that it is practically speaking, not possible based on the very construction of Bitcoin, and that more realistically, as people come to understand how Bitcoin credibly enforces a fixed supply of 21 million, that they will also come to the conclusion that for that reasons, that government cannot whitewash it from the world, and that it actually just serves as the best marketing. And this is something that you've said, that if your government wants to ban something, you should probably be interested in that and want to own that. And that is very true in this circumstance. And so whether it's Chuck Schumer getting on a soapbox, the guy in California, Brad Sherman, if it's China or India, like China and India have chosen the wrong monetary standard in the past, and that's not worked out well for them, that anybody who signals that they need to do something, even Congress putting this in the infrastructure bill, that all of it, whether it's attacking it, everything legitimizes it. It recognizes, hey, this thing is working so well that we now have to pay attention to it. That in itself sends a signal. And so there's a decision tree of, yeah, like it, there's only something to ban if it works. And that when an irrational economic actor starts to understand about that equation, if they understand a foundational element of how it enforces the fixed supply, they'll both understand that in any scenario, they have to own it, but that more realistically, it can't be banned because of the actual way that 21 million supply is enforced.
Yeah, I think I agree. All right, Daniel has a question for you. Daniel?
Yeah, hey guys, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Daniel, good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, Parker. How are you?
Good.
You didn't think I'd let you get away with this, right?
I was actually thinking that. Hi, Lauren. I was like, where's Lauren?
So before she asked the question, she's pretty expensive as she's moonlighting across podcasts here. So there will be a set invoice coming your way, I'm sure. She's pretty,
sure. My people will contact her people and sort it out.
All right, Lauren, do you remember your question?
Yes, I do.
Okay, right into the mic here.
Is it true that you'll be the mayor of Austin?
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a tough question. So I guess if I need to be the mayor of Austin, I will run and I will win, and I'll form a proper citadel here in Texas. My hope is that I'll get to continue to, do exactly what I'm doing now, which I think is the most important and impactful, which is helping people secure their Bitcoin better and helping more people understand Bitcoin. So I would only run, but if I ran, I would certainly win. But I would only do that if Bitcoiners around the world needed a citadel and that things were devolving in Austin that merited me needing to step to the plate. I don't have actual political ambitions. I'll leave that to others. I'd just rather take away the ability for those politicians to print money.
Right, I have another question now.
Sure.
Why do you think you will become mayor of Austin? Why do you think you'll certainly win?
Because Bitcoin's going to be the monetary standard, and I'm friends with a lot of Bitcoiners, and I think that all I need to do to win is to undo things that are very obviously screwed up, and that I'll have a very powerful voting bloc that's also very wealthy and can fund my campaign.
Well, if you need a campaign manager, I think
I'll sign you up.
Thank you.
All right, thanks guys, brilliant episode.
Yeah. See you, bye.
Bye, Lauren.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about Austin. That's a good question. I hadn't planned on talking about this, but I think it's a great topic to discuss. A lot of Bitcoiners in Austin. How's that working out? And what do you see as the long-term, the long-term direction for the Bitcoin capital of the world, as many people are calling it?
Yeah, I think it is selfish. Like it's both selfless or selfish and selfless, I would say, because I think about the idea of, your streets are paved with gold, that the best way to, I'm born and raised in Austin. I'm partial to it. It's in Texas. It's a little bit liberal, but Bitcoin changes people more than people change Bitcoin. So if we just survive long enough, that will take care of itself. But that the more Bitcoiners that are here, the more Bitcoin that's here. And that the city that has the most Bitcoin is actually going to be the city that flourishes the most. So that the way that you actually promote the greatest certainty in an uncertain world is attracting sound money. That when I think about, it's a little bit, I don't know what the right term is, but like, it might be a little bit audacious to think that you can recruit Bitcoiners, but I know that there are positive externalities to that. And I also see, like, in many ways, like, there's a lot of shit that doesn't make sense in the world, and that there's a lot of things about Texas and the high concentration of people that are actually sane and that value individual liberties, that also aligns very well with Bitcoin. And that in Austin, what Austin has is, it's not only, you know, kind of in ways protected by that kind of aggregate of like what Texas represents, but then also the people here and the mindset and the not putting up with bullshit, and the respect for individual and civil liberties. But that Austin, while it does skew a little bit liberal, it also is a tech hub. And that when you have a state that has a friendly regulatory climate, when you have a state that has a lot of energy resources paired with that friendly regulatory environment, and then you have a lot of other places around the world that are literally feeding on themselves and going insane, New York, San Francisco, other areas that have incredibly high taxes, that when people figure out Bitcoin, they literally, because I've sat down and talked to people about this, they start looking, they're basically free agents, and they start looking around the country, and they start thinking about the boxes to check as to what they would want in a place to live. And Austin, because of those kind of fundamental strategic things of it being a tech hub, being in a state that respects a lot more about individual rights and choices than not necessarily every other state, but on that same par. And then you combine it with the fact that Austin's a tech hub and you have a lot of development in the Bitcoin world, that it's an A/B test, and that it scores extremely high on a lot of figures. But what it scores highest on, because it is self-reinforcing, is there's a lot of Bitcoiners here, and Bitcoiners, you know, like they that it's a filter of values in many ways, not every ways. Like, I don't use the term maximalism because, like, we all literally have different opinions, and we don't all, we all think, you know, differently, but I think on the things that matter, I think we're aligned, and that people want to be around that, and that then attracts more. And one of the things that we're doing here, and I'm just going to take a second to plug it, is we're starting, we've just moved into our new offices at Unchained Capital. We're right at the corner of 6th and Congress, which, you know, if the governor ever screws something up, we're not marching up to the Capitol. We're going to make sure that he walks down the street to our office to answer to the Bitcoiners at the Bitcoin Commons. And what the Bitcoin Commons is, it's a space, it's not our space, but it's adjacent to our office, where it's going to be dedicated to the community. People are going to co-work, companies are going to sponsor. We're going to have a podcast studio. It's going to be Marty's home studio, official studio, safe when you come to town. We're going to record there, any podcasters that are coming through. But it's just, you know, like, there may not be quote unquote out Bitcoin community, but in Austin there is. And that I think that just given the state of the world and a lot of things that were, you know, kind of, you know, like in many ways in the water here, they are dictating that we're accumulating Bitcoiners. And the best way for any jurisdiction to get Bitcoin, given that 18.9 of them are already issued, is to attract Bitcoiners almost easier than actually delivering value.
Yeah, it's very true. And I think it's quite interesting that Austin seems to have, because of, you know, the variety of reasons that you mentioned, they seem to have acquired that. It seems to be the first place where people move to it because it's a Bitcoin place. Like, a lot of Bitcoiners will move away from New York, or would leave San Francisco or Canada or Australia or other medical gulags due to the recent insanity. But, you know, they leave and then they'll go somewhere where it's better because it is better. But Austin is one of the few places where they'll go there because there's Bitcoin there. There's a lot of Bitcoin. There's Bitcoin in them hills, in them Texan hills.
And there are. There will be more.
There will be more Bitcoin. I think Miami might be the second closest contender. And I think, you know, a lot of people have moved to Miami and Florida over the last couple of years with, you know, with their reckless naked face policy and letting people make their own decisions. But I still think that, you know, the Bitcoiners are still more likely to end up going to Texas, just to Austin in particular, because there's a lot more Bitcoiners there. I mean, it's just, you're going to have a social life around Bitcoiners if you go to Austin.
Yeah, I think, look, we, you know, I'm obviously partial. We, you know, at the end of the day, Bitcoin's going to be everywhere. So every city is going to be a Bitcoin city. We're just talking about like how we get to that end state with the least amount of disruption to our lives. But
and
I,
you know,
but
what's going to be the capital of the world and what's going to be the capital of the Bitcoin world. And I think Austin has taken a good claim to that.
Yeah. We're trying to, you know, make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. So with each added Bitcoiner, we don't really want to steal your Bitcoiners, but at the same time, we're actively trying.
Yeah, it's pretty compelling. Great steak, great meat, great farms, lots of hydrocarbons burning and keeping that, you.
The hydrocarbons is a big piece of it. You know, the natural resources that's something else that you know, we have a meetup in Houston, but that kind of combining the human capital that's here in the state with the natural resources, with the regulatory climate, with the nature of the grid, like Bitcoin and energy are synonymous. And that's that drives people to Texas, or that will drive a lot of that mining infrastructure. And so when you have a tech center opposite an energy center, it's like the perfect storm that others can't compete with. No real energy capital of the world in Florida, even though, look, I'm very supportive of Florida, but you know, I'm also just, there's deposits of copious amounts of natural gas and oil. And also there's wind and solar, which, you know, less important, but you know, there too.
Yeah. All right. Kelly, you have a question.
Yeah. Hey Parker, how are you?
Yeah. Kelly, we haven't convinced Kelly to move from Arizona yet, but, we'll get there. Kelly, how are you?
I get strange packages in the mail about moving to Texas, kind of like the Riddler, but I'm getting there. So Parker, I had a question. So when you talk to fund managers that are working with a lot of money or the high net worth individuals, and you use the argument of the credibly enforceable monetary policy, do you have a hard time getting them crossing the chasm comparing Bitcoin to a digital gold, or do they view it as that already? And I guess, what is your argument for getting them across the digital bridge, I guess, so to speak?
Most of the time, I would say it's like thinking in that context of someone is on zero and you're not 100% sure what the idea or statement is that's going to be able to unlock and then and allow them to see something that they didn't previously see. I think that what I have found is there's probably two elements that are most useful, because I go into it readily accepting that I did not understand gold, why gold was money before I met Safe, and that I try to anchor to the idea that that people don't have to understand gold in order to understand Bitcoin, but what they have to accept is that the world previously converged on one form of money. Even if that wasn't like 100% share, it was close. So like, they don't have to understand why gold was money, but they have to accept that there was this thing called the gold standard. It existed for a reason. Even if they don't understand it, that they had to converge onto that. But that the world did converge to that standard. And then when I combine that with the fact that if people think about that the reality that every individual in the world only interacts with one form of money, that I focus them on those points. Because then I say, imagine there is a form of money that has a fixed supply, that has a zero rate of change. If money does converge to one, or people are incentivized to opt into larger monetary networks that are more secure, and that you know, if you A/B tested it, that imagine it's not Bitcoin, that you would opt into a form of money that could not increase in supply, then that will send you on a path of trying to find what is the best form of money. And I basically anchor them first to understanding why it is relevant, because if I get them down the rabbit hole of how Bitcoin credibly enforces a fixed supply of 21 million, that they can't actually get there without first understanding why it would be relevant and why it would be viable as money if you assume that it was true. So I tell those people, assume it were to be true. There's a saying in Bitcoin that's, you know, verify, don't trust, but your path to understanding it is first understand the why. Have you Safe's book, Bitcoin Standard, is the best place to start for that. You know, and then there's other books to understand like how the network actually works. But if you evaluate, okay, let me assume that there's 21 million, would this be viable and valuable as money? If you get to the answer, no, you don't need to understand the how. But if you understand the why, that's a critical input to understand the how. So I really anchored them to this idea that the world did converge to one form of money. It wasn't by coincidence. And that starting to think about it as, you know, even if Bitcoin's in digital form, you know, assume it were to be true, evaluate whether that is viable and valuable, and then I can help you understand, you know, the how behind the why.
Perfect. Thank you.
Oh, also, Kelly, for you, if I become mayor, we're on Congress here. I'm gonna eliminate cars from like the entire downtown corridor. We're gonna focus on aesthetics. But I can't do that if you don't come and support me.
I know. I wanted to congratulate you on your highly aesthetic choice of new office, and I very much looking forward to ripping out all the pavement and turning it to grass and trees.
Wonderful.
Excellent stuff. All right, Peter, you have a question back on Bitcoin and US dollar inflation.
Sure. Yeah, and good to connect, Parker, and thanks for all your insights shared today. Really wonderful stuff. And very interesting to hear that you're considering running for mayor in Austin. I think the US is going to need all the help it can get to compete with El Salvador. So perhaps this could be the thing, having Parker Lewis as mayor of a major city, that might just allow them to do this. So that's great to hear. But my question was on inflation, and the first part of the conversation related to definancialization as a result of Bitcoin. So the question is, do you think that Bitcoinization will end up leading to inflation for the US dollar? A lot of people, it seems intuitive that it would, but there's kind of debate around this question, because some people say that not only will a competing medium of exchange in the form of Bitcoin decrease demand for US dollars, which means that the value, the purchasing power of US dollars goes down, but that it also means that the value for US dollar denominated debt instruments like government bonds will also fall. And since the total number of government bonds issued determines the broad money supply, that'll actually result in the total supply of US dollars falling, because demand for the bonds is going down, and which will mean that there's a constraint on money supply growth. And so some people say that actually Bitcoinization can happen in a way that doesn't entail hyperinflation for the US dollar. Would you mind sharing your view on that issue and what you see playing out in the case that we do have a hyper Bitcoinization?
Yeah, so I think in short, I would view Bitcoin in all, at least in all long-term scenarios, as inflationary for all fiat currencies. That all fiat currencies will trend to zero, and not only their purchasing power of Bitcoin, but also of real goods and services, which is ultimately what matters. But the way that I think about it, and I think it, part of the dynamic here is, and we talked about this a bit, or at least on a different thread, which was, if we live in a world where there's 85 to 88 trillion of dollar denominated debt in the United States, just using the United States as an example. And today, even though the government, or the Fed, I should say the Fed, not the government, private institution, even though the Fed has printed, you know, over $8 trillion or digitally created $8 trillion, that that the credit system remains highly leveraged, and that there are still far too few dollars to satisfy the debts that exist in the world. And that if we impaired the impulse to purchase that debt, that it is the same exact scenario of why the Fed has to print money, such that, you know, because this is the process of definancialization. I can just explain it from a micro level, because Michael Saylor talks about this too, where Saylor talks about the scenario where people were holding treasuries and making like 30%, because everyone was like legging into bonds as they were worried about the economic future, and that that actually caused the appreciation of bonds. Well, I would, like, in that time of 2018-19, I was doing the same thing when the Fed was tightening, because I understood that this would cause a rush into US treasuries. But that only exists to a certain extent. And as like the treasury rate, you know, declined as the appreciation of the bonds happened, I then looked at it and said, okay, I'm converting all of these treasuries to Bitcoin. So I'm essentially selling treasuries and buying Bitcoin. I'm impairing, you know, marginal demand for treasuries. Well, if that starts to get to any critical mass, which it inevitably will, I don't think we're close to it at this point. The global credit system is like 400 trillion, Bitcoin's 1 trillion, but that it will happen at some point in time where people are going to look at this equation and say, do I hold and own a bond that virtually returns zero and that has massive amounts of counterparty risk and is denominated to a currency that print, which they print? I'm going to sell that asset, which is going to impair the asset price, which is going to impair the credit complex, and I'm going to buy Bitcoin. Well, that in its own right is kind of deflationary. But once that credit system starts to get to a critical mass of people doing that, whether it's related to Bitcoin or otherwise selling those assets, that it is actually what induces the printing of more base money. Like if you are unwilling to buy those assets, the Federal Reserve will. Because they have to have those financial assets at a certain level to be able to support existing debt levels. Otherwise, their entire system collapses. So it's like these things are dynamic, that as people figure out Bitcoin, they're going to sell financial assets, buy Bitcoin. That's going to pressure financial assets, which is going to not only impair marginal demand for credit, but also inflate credit. And in response to that, it's actually going to accelerate the inducement of quantitative easing. And so it is that printing of base money that's linked to this, that's like, it's just a vicious cycle. And so there might be like some intermittent kind of deflationary implication, but that what it will 100%, not possibility, not probably certainty, induces more and more printing of base money, which then starts to loop back being like, oh, that's why I own Bitcoin, because my dollars are being devalued.
So I guess even though central banks are nominally independent, the problem comes when governments are faced with the idea of defaulting. Because if there's not enough money in the system, governments have interest-bearing bonds nominally. And so in practical terms, if the central bank doesn't create more base money so that there is enough money circulating in the economy for the government to pay the interest on their bonds, then basically the entire system would collapse because the government would default.
Yeah, and like their very lifeblood, their relevance to society goes away with it, essentially, and that's why they in all circumstances would pursue printing, because they want to maintain the size of the credit system.
All right, Nathan, another Texas question.
Yeah, I guess two questions in one. I've heard you talking about the attraction to Austin for Bitcoin-oriented folks, but those aren't the only ones chasing into Austin. And I'm wondering from your perspective, I guess one, a general question is, what about Austin would lead anyone to believe that it's not going to be any different than every other place that's gone through this, such as California? And then, but I want to layer that with the people pouring into Austin. Do you have a sense of their political orientation, at least as they come into Austin?
Yeah, I think it's like, it's a reasonable concern. I anchor to fundamentals, which are, because I see those people, we've had a number of local elections, so we get to see how they actually think. It turns out that when, you have controllable, like petty crime and vagrants, living on your doorsteps and violating your rights, that when you come to another place that you actually do not want to replicate it. That those things most acutely, like the people that love the weather in California and love the beach, they're coming to like 95 degree plus weather in the summer. And, we got some rivers and water, but they're fleeing the things that they actually love and why they were in California for some reason. And that at least what I'm seeing, it's not let's come here and like redo those same experiments. But then I anchor to the fundamental of like Bitcoin actually changes people. And if we have a strong contingent of Bitcoiners and that more people are going to figure out Bitcoin, like they don't go the other way. And that also the ability for that insanity to exist in the first place is inherently impaired. So it's more along we have to survive to a point where we get a critical mass of Bitcoiners and we can actually create our own luck in that sense by adding Bitcoiners to our troops, not only by educating about Bitcoin, but by recruiting those already on the up and up. So I understand the concern, but I haven't seen it, or I've seen the opposite in practice. So
how credible do you think the secession talk is?
I don't think so. There's a great quote by Sam Houston, which is the founding father of Texas, which is Texas does not need the United States, but the United States needs Texas. And so the founding father of Texas realized that there was a benefit to Texas being as part of the United States, and that we shouldn't be so arrogant to believe that we necessarily know better, and that that Texas will ultimately help save the United States, I think, rather than seceding. But I do have a call at 11 that I really need to hop to. But we can, hopefully we'll come back on at some point and we can continue this conversation. I really enjoyed it, Saif, and it's an honor. You've obviously been a foundational part of my own understanding of Bitcoin. So really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us, Parker. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. Have a good day.
All right. See you guys.
Cheers.